From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How you doing, Ann? We got a lot of news.
Lot of news.
But of course, the one big item of news from last week that everyone is expectantly waiting to hear you discuss is your husband's haircut. your husband's haircut, because you left us hanging.
First of all, it ended up being a little bit of a test of how long it takes my husband to listen to the podcast, because he didn't say anything. And my mom said something the next day. I was like, let's see when my husband says something. So this morning, he came in. He was dropping our son at school. He came in and said, so you've been talking about my hair.
Talking about my hair.
So it took him six days to listen.
Do you have a rule about spousal content? There are these debates that rage. And sometimes if you produce a lot of content,
you can't
maybe
keep
it's hard to keep
it.
Up.
Yes, totally. So I basically said to him over the weekend, I have this hair cutting shears thing. You can tell how professional I'm going to be at this. I have it ready to go. I bought it, I don't know, April, May, but we never used it because both my guys decided to forego a haircut for a while. So I was like, I should bring it with me because we were in New Jersey and we were coming back to New York. And I was like, I should bring it with me. And my husband was like, well, you know, Monday is actually just, I can do it anytime after that. So it went from we're doing it Monday to we're doing it after. So now he tells me this weekend, but
haven't done it.
No, I'm ready to go.
So is he aware that the Electoral College has voted?
Yeah, he's aware. In fact,
I think it's a little late. Is he trying to challenge the
results?
No,
he said anytime after. And then this morning he actually said, well, you know, Trump still hasn't admitted it. But like, if that's the standard, he will never cut his hair again.
I don't think that's the haircut standard.
It's not the haircut standard. Joe Biden is officially the president-elect.
Is your husband a Republican senator?
He is not. He's definitely not. But
is your husband one of 126 House members who signed that amicus brief?
He is not. He's definitely not. But yes, I think, you know, he's waited a long time. I think honestly, he's a little nervous about cutting his hair, but I think he's a lot nervous about my cutting his hair.
Right.
Which is not, it's not unfair, Preet. I've already told
you
him
I'm going to document this for posterity.
Yeah, 100%. I'm also going to do it. I've already declared we have to do it at a time where there is a barbershop open in case of emergency. Like, I can't do it Sunday morning when there's no place he could get his haircut. I suspect the haircut's going to be a tragicomedy, but we'll see.
I'm sure it'll be great.
Yeah.
Because, Anne, you do everything well.
Thank you. I'm pretty sure this is going to go in the negative column, but I shouldn't say this in case he listens before the haircut. I'm going to be awesome.
Are you sure he listened, or did one of his friends give him a heads up?
It's possible. It's also possible.
Or like your mom, maybe. All right. So all week we've been thinking about whether or not Bill Barr would resign, be fired. I intended for us to speculate today about what would happen with Bill Barr, but the speculation is no longer necessary. Because William Barr, Attorney General of the United States of America, he did not announce it. He wrote a letter, and we're going to get to the letter in a moment. It's another one in the pantheon.
Quite a letter. Yes.
Of obsequious, ridiculous, fawning resignation letters when his resignation was probably kind of desired by the president. But it was announced by tweet by Donald Trump, who said the Attorney General was leaving. It's not effective immediately. It's effective on December 23rd, right before Christmas. Where to begin? Are you surprised?
No. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised because in recent times we've seen he's fallen on the wrong side of Donald Trump, and there has been rumbling and reporting that he would leave. But if you had told me 6 months ago, do you expect Bill Barr to leave 3 weeks before the swearing in of the next president? I would have said, no. Yeah, that's surprising. I haven't gone all the way back, but we checked and the team double checked. You know, Loretta Lynch stayed in her post until January 20th of that year. Michael B. Mukasey, who was the final attorney general for George W. Bush, stayed until January 20th. So the precedent is, you know, some people leave months before the end of an administration or a term or a year before. But once you're there, post-Thanksgiving, and it's the final weeks and we're in transition, you stick around till the last day unless something strange is going on. And there has been speculation. I don't buy this, but there's been speculation in Bill Barr's favor there's some speculation in the opposite direction, but speculation in Bill Barr's favor that he wanted to absent himself in the final days because there's crazy stuff coming down, whether pardons or self-pardons or whatnot, and he didn't want to be a part of it.
I don't buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know why I don't buy that? I don't buy it because the pardon power is the president's constitutional power, and it's as close to an absolute power as you can get. And the president has not used or relied upon the pardon attorney's office in the Department of Justice. And so, and obviously, Flynn was just pardoned. Roger Stone's sentence was commuted. I mean, Barr has overseen many of those. And so I don't buy that. I mean, I suspect, and actually, I will also note that I kind of think that this is less of a big deal than I think a lot of commentators and others do. I mean, yes, he's leaving a month early, but it's just a month early. He was leaving either way on January 20th. And I mean, the one thing it is a sign of to me is that there's nothing that he is currently working on that he feels committed to staying to do. And obviously that's unless he was fired.
Other than to December 23rd, because he did say he wanted to.
Yeah, he's leaving December 23rd. Sorry. Yeah, so he's leaving less than a month early. And so the more interesting question here, I think, is was he fired? This is a complicated thing to go through. And I think we should go through some of the ways in which, like, what Bill Barr has done during the past couple of years. And we've talked a lot about him. I mean, our lead producer noted yesterday that there's almost not an episode we've done where we haven't talked about Barr. So I sort of think, you know, in the context of all this, it's more interesting to talk about, like, who he was, what he's been. And frankly, it was in some ways a positive thing to me, Preet, because I sort of feel like it's a harbinger that the Department of Justice is changing. I think that change is really important. I think Barr has been overly political in the department. And so, you know, he's on his way out. We don't know his number two, who Trump is elevating to be the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, is a civil lawyer. I don't know very much about him. But, you know, he's got less than a month. And so I feel like this sort of transition of DOJ back to a fully rule of law institution, I hope, is coming. But anyway, I think people were speculating a lot on it. And one other question I had, I just had a question about the timing. I mean, it felt to me like we were watching, you know, we were literally watching Biden be elected president of the United States by the Electoral College yesterday, which, by the way, was the first time I'd ever seen it, watching all these electors and states.
It's usually pro forma. The fact that it's huge news is something and has to do with, you know, the president being a denialist, if that's a word. Other people have joked, like, Biden has won so many times that he's actually going to be the 67th president of the United States.
He is the winningest president.
He won Georgia like seven times.
It is true. Yet last night we were like calling our six-year-old to come out and watch it. And he was kind of like, again, you know, it's sort of like, how many times are you going to make me do this? And obviously he wanted to play with Legos. So he had other things to do. But like, literally the minute it happened, Trump tweets out. I mean, he can't let Biden have that moment of Biden is the president of the United States. He has to sort of, you know, try to control the news cycle. And look, he did for a few minutes. And then I think the responsible news outlets decided to say, like, look, we'll talk about Bill Barr later, but like, let's stay focused on the Electoral College.
You look, that was my personal experience. As I told you last night, when the news broke that Bill Barr had resigned, I got immediately called by CNN to come on their broadcast. I didn't have time to put on a tie or a jacket, and I was standing by, and I'm watching Anderson Cooper on CNN talk with his guests, and someone said, exactly like you said, look, this is another example of Donald Trump trying to change the subject from what the really big news is, and that is that Joe Biden has won the vote in the Electoral College, 306 electoral votes. And Anderson literally looks back at that person and says, well, let's not let him change the story and change the subject. Let's go back to talking about Vice President Biden or President-elect Biden. And I got texted, sorry for the fire drill, we're not having you on, which I totally get and respect. And I have you to talk about it with today for a great, you know, period of time.
Yeah, exactly. And there's plenty of time to talk about Bill Barr as Attorney General. And yesterday I thought was the day to talk about Joe Biden as President-elect. So I'm with you.
Do you think he was trying to avoid being fired? There's this whole debate about whether it's better to be fired or to resign. Obviously, listeners know where I fall on that divide, given my experience. But it could be that he knew he was in trouble. The president has been saying nasty things about Bill Barr. The president has been unhappy with Barr. I mean, it's just another example. The other thing we should say about this whole saga before we go through the litany of Bill Barr's sins and a couple of things he did the right way more recently, is you can prostrate yourself, you can humiliate yourself, you can embarrass yourself to no end almost. But if you don't do everything possible in favor of the president, whether it violates principle, whether it violates regulation, whether it violates your oath, you're dead to him. And, you know, the question a lot of people are asking, and that I wonder if these men are asking themselves, whether it's Jeff Sessions or some of the people at Fox News or Bill Barr, who have ruined their reputations to be thrown in the trash by the same person who they ruined their reputations for, was it worth it? Was it worth it?
You know what's amazing to me? That any idea that the president would be loyal, I think it's look, the president is transactional, right? And Bill Barr has helped him enormously in carrying out the transactions the president wanted to carry out, whether it was making the investigation to the 2016 election and Russian hacking of the election, making that seem like it was a witch hunt, so discrediting that, or whether it was making sure Michael Flynn was not prosecuted. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which Bill Barr has gone out of his way. I still think that there are a couple that are sort of really stand out in my mind, even above Flynn, which is the Barr's summary of Robert Mueller's lengthy opinion. Basically, you know, Mueller puts out this report, and part one is about whether or not the Trump campaign conspired with the Russians in the election hacking and the release of emails. And the second was whether or not the president obstructed justice and obstructed that investigation. And remember, Barr's summary, I can remember you and I talking about it, basically said, you know, Mueller didn't find anything, right? I mean, and then Mueller had to come out and did something that is extraordinary for Bob Mueller, which is to write a letter saying, actually, you're wrong on like the facts and the conclusions about my report. And later when we saw the Mueller report, it was very clear that Barr, in my view, had basically misstated what Robert Mueller had written down.
And then delayed it too.
And delayed it, right. That's right.
It was both the sort of obfuscation of it, the distortion of it, but then that's the only story out there for some weeks. So that's the only thing that gets imprinted on people's minds.
Yeah, he framed it. Exactly. He put it out before Robert Mueller had spoken. He spoke and he framed it. And he sort of set the tone for what the report would say. It turned out not to be accurate. But then, you know, a lot of people have to sort of push it back and say, well, that Barr wasn't accurate. Here's what it really says. And the other example was the Ukraine whistleblower that led to the president being impeached. And you'll remember that Barr basically said there was no crime and he didn't even open an investigation. And so Barr has been the president's bag man in an enormous way, in my view. So in some ways, like, is it surprising to me that the president would potentially fire him? No, because again, when the president wanted Barr there for him to say that there was election fraud or to say that there were investigations into election fraud, that's where Barr, he didn't go there.
What's interesting about that arc that I don't really understand is on the question of election fraud, Bill Barr went on CNN, said to Wolf Blitzer, and we've talked about this, speculating months ago to lay the foundation for this narrative that the president you knew was going to rely on and is still relying on even after the Electoral College has voted, that there would be massive voter fraud. He said he didn't have any evidence of it, but he predicted it because it's common sense. He said thousands of people from other countries could send in thousands of ballots that were fraudulent. Remember, there was a whole business of the ballots found in Pennsylvania by or near a river. And he exaggerated, as you discussed at one point, some voter fraud from Texas. So leading up to the election, he was doing all sorts of things to set up the narrative that the president wanted. He also did this thing where, you know, contrary to decades of policy, he was authorizing certain kinds of election investigations even before those elections had been certified. So it's a little bit surprising to me, ends up being a good thing. But at the end of the day, when push came to shove and he was asked the question, you know, is there substantial or widespread election fraud, voter fraud, he said no. He said there wasn't to a degree that would have affected the outcome of the election. So he did all those other things in favor of the president, which I don't think were well-founded.
He also basically said there was no systemic fraud.
Such that it could change the, yeah, such that it would change the results of the election, which
exactly.
is what matters.
Yep.
So it's kind of peculiar. Let's talk about his other sins in the eyes of Donald Trump. So he says that thing, which is anathema to the president, and caused legal luminaries Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis to rebuke him. And then the other thing, how, I don't know how accurate this is, but there's a U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI, and IRS investigation into the tax affairs of Hunter Biden, the president-elect's son. And there is reporting that Bill Barr knew about that some months ago and appropriately, legitimately, kept it quiet, doesn't seem to have informed the White House and didn't allow it to become public, and that might have affected the election. And that was another sin against him, right?
Yes, and the president tweeted out very angry, why didn't Bill Barr tell us before the election? It would have made a difference in the election. So there's this fascinating thing where we know that Barr knows there's an investigation happening into Hunter Biden, potentially as early as 2018, has been publicly reported. We don't know the exact timing. So there's this investigation. Barr doesn't talk about it. As you say, exactly right. That's the policy at the Department of Justice. So he follows the policy. And yet, you know, he spent all his time working on this 2016, trying to, you know, discredit the investigation to the 2016 election. He's appointed a special counsel in John Durham to continue. I mean, he's thwarted in many ways the sort of longstanding norms and policies of the department. I mean, the Michael Flynn motion to dismiss is another example. And yet in this really key way, he did not divulge this thing that the president would have been so happy to have heard, right? And really would have used politically. And so there's a line he's drawn, and I can't explain what that line is, but there's, I don't know, you call it peculiar. I would almost say contradictory.
Well, it just shows like everyone has some line other than Trump. So you put Trump in a category of his own. He has no line. He doesn't care. And then you have other people who are sycophantic and kind of do the bidding of the president. I kind of put Jeff Sessions in that category, but he had a line, which is the ethics officers at the Department of Justice said, for appearance reasons, he should recuse himself from all matters relating to the Russia probe, and he did, right? Even Fox News, so take it outside of the category of, you know, particular human beings, even Fox News propelled Donald Trump, set the agenda in a way that helped Donald Trump, played down the virus, did all sorts of other things that I think reasonable journalists should not have done. But then they, from time to time, you know, utter the truth, and they have some line. And in all of these instances, at the end of the day, they have upset Donald Trump and Donald Trump supporters, and they end up earning the most wrath from his supporters. At that rally Donald Trump did a couple of weeks ago, the media outlet that was yelled at the most, that was mocked the most, was Fox News, because they had gone, you know, rogue on Trump. And Bill Barr, I mean, I wonder if part of it is, as you and I both, and I will not speak for you, but, you know, I was mistaken when Bill Barr came on the scene and suggested he's an establishment guy, you know, don't agree with him on a lot of things, and he's very conservative, but an institutionalist. And I wonder if part of this, and again, this is all, you know, speculation about a hypothesis, as they say in Miller's Crossing, if part of this is trying to save his own reputation as an institutionalist, knowing that he's going down the tubes, knowing that the president doesn't feel so fond of him anymore, that he sort of ostentatiously did a couple of these things to rescue his own reputation among his friends and colleagues in the bar. Is that silly or not?
I don't know. I think, you know, Bill Barr threw his hat in with the president and became in many ways, I think, the president's most ardent cabinet supporter. I mean, remember Bill Barr, you know, when the president wanted to go to St. John's Cathedral in Washington, D.C., when they had protesters during the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, Barr is the one who had told the law enforcement folks that the square should be cleared. I mean, he denied giving the order at that moment in time, but he admitted that he had earlier in the day said, you know, get it done.
But right? It was done, right? He is the passive voice in some way to deny responsibility.
Yes, it should be done, or I don't remember the specifics, but it was clear he played a role in having the sort of law enforcement folks clear that block. And so, you know, he's been the president's right hand at a lot of critical times. And the president has, I think, a deep disregard for the rule of law. I mean, he just doesn't, and we'll talk about it when it comes to the Supreme Court and the president's appointments and the president believing that because he appointed people into positions that they owe him and have to do his bidding. And so, you know, I think Barr has been a loyal lieutenant. What I think could have happened, and again, you know, we don't know the inside baseball, and we don't know whether the president fired him, whether the president would have fired him. The president certainly, you know, it's not unusual for him to go on a tirade. I mean, he has tweeted against Chris Wray, the director of the FBI. He has tweeted against the head of the CIA, right? And so, but they haven't been fired. And so we don't know. I just want to sort of speculate, but caution, like it's really difficult to know without reporting on sort of the inside baseball. But I also think it's possible that Barr got to a point where he realized he could be fired. I don't think Bill Barr wants to be fired.
I think that's true.
I mean, he's like the ultimate, right? He's like the ultimate loyalist. He did not make the decision you made, which was like, I'm going to do what's right. And if you want to fire me, fire me. Bill Barr has made a decision of like, you know, he staked his reputation on being this president's most ardent defender and a defender of the president's vision. And we should talk about Barr's resignation letter, because I think that's like, it's up there with Rod Rosenstein's.
Well, there's a lot of parallels there. So not only did Bill Barr not want to be fired, and not only did Rod Rosenstein not want to be fired, they also don't want to hear a cross word from the president. They don't want to be tweeted negatively about. They kind of want to leave on the best terms possible. And they understand, you know, a lengthy textual stroking of the ego of Donald Trump would probably, you know, cause the president to sort of amicably say, thank you for your service, you were terrific, and then move on, which is what happened here. And this letter, boy, it's... it doesn't thank Trump for his sense of humor and the long chats that I think Rod Rosenstein,
long walks on the beach, pina coladas.
And getting caught in the rain.
Rod Rosenstein's wasn't quite that bad, but it was basically
you didn't mention pina coladas? I thought
it was pretty bad.
Getting caught in the rain?
I always think about it as the pina colada letter.
I don't think he mentioned making love at midnight. That is definitely true. Even still, like I said, everyone has a line. Even Rod Rosenstein has a line how far you will go.
So this letter, Preet, let me ask you this. Who wrote it?
Ivanka Trump.
Did Bill Barr
write it? I bet he did write it.
Did Bill Barr write it? You don't think that the White House gave him some language?
Well, maybe, but if the president had given him language, there would be more exclamation marks, and it would be less grammatical.
And all caps. You know what's missing from this letter?
Hearts.
When the president fired you, did you send out a note to the employees in the Southern District?
Yeah, in fact, as I sat in my office waiting to be fired and get that call, because I knew it was coming that Saturday afternoon, all that remained was writing a thank you note to the staff and to the lawyers. And yeah,
exactly.
There's nothing about...
What did you say? I mean, you basically...
I said, you know, something along the lines of, you're the best people I've ever worked with, and it was an honor and a privilege to serve with you. I don't have the exact words, and I don't have a copy of the email, because then I lost access to the system. And how proud
of
them.
And do you know what's missing from Bill Barr's letter?
I know what you're gonna say. Go ahead.
He did not thank the men and women of the Department of Justice a single time.
Well, he once compared them to, what did he compare them to, preschoolers?
It is so glaring to me. I mean, I read the letter the first time with the pina colada lens on of the wow. I read it a second time with is he running for office? Because this is a political speech. This is not a lawyer's letter. This is not a cabinet member's letter. This is a rah-rah Trump victory campaign fundraising letter kind of thing. It's not at all what you would expect. And then the third time I read it, I thought, God, you know, when I left being AG, the single most important thing to me was to say thank you to the men and women of the department, the amazing men and women I'd worked with. And I am sure I knew before you even said it that that's what you would have done.
I've told the story a number of times. The thing that made me the saddest on that Saturday afternoon, I was being fired and had to leave the building. And I was in my office with June Kim, my deputy, and with Joan Lochnane, who was the chief counsel, who were kind of babysitting me as I was about to be fired. And I said, I was very sad because I said, I'm not gonna be able to say goodbye to everyone in person. And I was getting a little bit emotional about it. And they looked at me and they said, well, you know, you can come back on Monday and we'll let you in the building. And I'm like, you will? And that calmed me down. So yeah, so you and I think have the right sentiments here. Maybe there's another occasion on which Bill Barr will do it, but the fact that he chose not to say anything about the people in the department who do all the work, by the way.
Even one line of thank you. Yeah, who do all the work.
Is telling.
And there was a lot of I about Bill Barr, and then there was a lot of you about the president. But it's an astonishing letter, and in my view also, and I really just cannot believe the letter in some ways, and I'll read the part. But I think he crossed a line that he shouldn't have crossed. And it's deeply partisan and political in a way that I don't believe that the Attorney General of the United States should be. People disagree. I mean, part of being a lawyer is that you go into court and you argue with people. I mean, there are two sides in every litigation dispute. It's
part of what you do. Well, sometimes you argue with your client, too.
And yeah. Yes, that's true, too. But it's not personal, and it's not meant to, you know, we don't vilify one another, right? I mean, we may deeply disagree with other litigants or people who were sort of up against, but the tone of this letter is not that.
Do you think the first draft said, "Dear Leader," instead of "Dear Mr. President"? I think it probably did. And then maybe the Deputy Attorney General or somebody else fixed it for him.
So here's the lines that I am particularly focused on, but I want to hear some of your favorite lines. But it says, "Dear Mr. President." It was written yesterday, December 14th, 2020. And I'm going down to the second paragraph. And by the way, I will also note that the first sentence is, "I appreciate the opportunity to update you this afternoon on the department's review of voter fraud allegations in the 2020 election." Yes, and how these allegations will continue to be pursued, meaning, oh, I may have said publicly that there's no election fraud and that it's over, but I'm telling you now for the purposes of my resignation letter that there's still review going on.
Will you be my Valentine kind of thing?
Yes. And he goes on to say in the second paragraph, quote, "Your record is all the more historic because you accomplished it in the face of relentless, implacable resistance. Your 2016 victory speech, in which you reached out to your opponents and called for working together for the benefit of the American people, was immediately met by a partisan onslaught against you in which no tactic, no matter how abusive and deceitful, was out of bounds."
He goes on. Can I read another one along these lines? That just appeals to the most aggrieved politician in the history of the world, Donald J. Trump. He says, quote, "Few could have weathered these attacks, much less forge ahead with a positive program for the country." And then he goes outside of his lane, right? Outside of issues relating to the Justice Department. "You built the strongest and most resilient economy in American history, one that has brought unprecedented progress to those previously left out." Is he following the latest news on the economy? Does he understand the unemployment rate?
I don't think he is.
Is he paying attention to anything that's going on in the United States of America or in the world? The letter goes on in this vein. And look, I think it accomplishes the immediate purpose of Bill Barr, which is to pacify the president, leave on good terms, not be mean tweeted at, and ride into the sunset. So I guess, you know, good for you, Mr. Barr.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's really not a letter about the Department of Justice. It's largely about the president's, and this is why I asked you who wrote it. It's about the president's, what the president would tout as his political achievements: Operation Warp Speed, military strength, appointing judges, the economy. And so it's really fascinating. I mean, there is a shout out to law enforcement.
In paragraph four. It doesn't come till paragraph four.
Paragraph four. And it's both, it looks like it's just law enforcement in general who risk their lives to keep our community safe. But that's sort of one of the like 10 things. He talks about the vaccine. It's a really, really strange letter. And yeah, it's a really strange letter.
All right. So now let's do what anchors on responsible television did last night and go back to what's truly important, not just the Attorney General having left a few weeks early and his legacy kind of speaks for itself. But, you know, this final case that everyone thought would be manna from heaven for the president, and that Jenna Ellis keeps speaking about how they were going to be victorious in the Supreme Court. And by the way, this is a Supreme Court that has six conservatives, six Republican-appointed justices, only three by Democrats, and three of the nine, full third of the court, appointed by President Trump himself, who believes in these principles of loyalty in one way, you know, not both ways, but one way at least. And you had this astonishing lawsuit brought by the state of Texas, Texas versus Pennsylvania, and basically amounted to, you know, a sovereign state in the United States asking the Supreme Court, as a matter of original jurisdiction, to throw out the votes of four other states that Donald Trump lost. And lots of legal commentators, almost to a person, proclaimed that this was a stupid case, that there would be no standing, that under principles of federalism and states' rights, that, by the way, conservatives used to be in favor of. By the way, conservatives also used to be against frivolous litigation. I guess that's gone out the window also. And said, you know, the citizens of Texas have been harmed by some irregularities, they allege, in these other states. And I guess if you're not a legal practitioner and you've been sort of trained and socialized to be worried about the things that the president can do and what he can get away with, there's a lot of consternation about that case. And maybe we should take a step back and explain a couple of basic things. And the procedural posture, most cases that are in the Supreme Court, virtually all, except for maybe one or two a year in recent times, arises because somebody has a case in a trial court and one side loses and they appeal to the appellate court, and then one side loses in that skirmish, and then it goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court either agrees or doesn't agree to hear the case. And in those circumstances, it takes four justices to vote to hear the case. And even then, only a tiny percentage of cases that go to the Supreme Court are actually heard by the Supreme Court. They just don't have time to deal with thousands and thousands of cases that litigants want the Supreme Court to hear. There's another kind of case where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, and that means that they would be the first court, not the last court, but the first court to hear the controversy or the case. And that's, for example, in circumstances when you have states who have fights with each other. And as you may have heard people talk about this over the last week, that happens, for example, when two states border each other and they have a fight about water rights, or they have a fight about borders, you know, the kinds of disputes you might imagine. Do I have that essentially right, Anne? And when you were Attorney General, did you have fights with other states?
We did. In fact, we had a case of original jurisdiction in the United States Supreme Court. And you are completely right that it's very rare. But we had a case. It was a riparian rights case.
Water. That's water, right?
Has to do with the... Yes, rivers. There's a river between the state of Delaware and the state of New Jersey. And BP, the oil company, wanted to... I don't remember all the details, but they essentially wanted... to set up some drilling mechanism on the river on the New Jersey side. And the state of New Jersey had, and this was prior to my becoming AG, but the state of New Jersey, I believe, had sued the great state of Delaware that was then represented by my friend Beau Biden. And of course, the vice president, the president-elect's son, who's since passed away from cancer. But Beau Biden and the state of Delaware litigated their case. We litigated our case, and we lost to the great state of Delaware in the United States Supreme Court. But it was really interesting for me because I sort of was like, why is this case in the Supreme Court? And, you know, and it goes back to like the English grant of the river and the land in the river and what state. It was a very complex matter. And it really was. And what the Supreme Court did in that case is they appointed a special master to make findings of fact.
Can I ask you a question?
So they would do that themselves.
Can I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes. Is this more about rivers than you ever wanted to
talk about? No, man, runs through it. I love rivers. I'm a big fan of rivers, whatever that means. That's how pathetic my chit-chat has become. So some of the indicia of the Texas suit not really being believed in, even by people in Texas. John Cornyn made some disparaging remarks about the lawsuit. But it was pointed out that the Solicitor General of Texas had not signed the brief. Not every state has a Solicitor General. It's a position that's recently created in some states, including, I think, New Jersey and not that long ago in New York.
That's right.
But if the state has an Attorney General and you're bringing a suit like that in the Supreme Court, what did it tell you that the Solicitor General's name was not on it?
Yeah. And so the Solicitor General is usually the person in charge of the like Supreme Court litigation, the appellate litigation, and really oversees that often on behalf of the Attorney General or works with the Attorney General very closely on that. The fact that the Texas Solicitor General didn't join is a huge sign of, and by the way, those are usually Solicitor General are excellent lawyers, and they're usually, you know, among the sort of like smartest lawyers on the Constitution, state and federal constitutions. And so to me, it's a sign that they just didn't believe in it as a matter of law. And we should talk about this for a second. I mean, I think it wasn't just Pennsylvania that Texas sued, right? They also sued all four states, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And it was a very political lawsuit, obviously. If those states, and they were asking for all those votes to be invalidated, which would have pushed Joe Biden below the 270 Electoral College votes that he needed to become president. And they did it by asking for a number of things. But the general idea is really that a person sitting in Dallas gets to tell a person sitting in Pittsburgh whether or not their vote counts, right? And it can't possibly, I mean, literally one state telling other states, we don't like the way you run your elections. We don't think that that's fair and constitutional. Like, it is, it's really radical, Preet. And I think, like, that I sort of think, like, we've all dismissed it as, like, you know, we've talked about it as lawyers as, like, that's ridiculous. There's no basis for Texas to bring that claim, and we should talk about why Texas doesn't have, like, technically the legal term is standing, right? They don't have a right to basically bring that claim. But it goes beyond that. I mean, what's sort of being said is, like, one state was trying to invalidate the votes of four other states, and 126 Republican Congress people joined, 17 other state AGs joined, the President of the United States joined. And so, you know, I think we talked about this for like 20 seconds last week, basically saying, like, oh, you know, Texas sued, without a full understanding of, like, it really was, as a legal matter, there was no basis to bring this lawsuit. But it goes beyond, I think. I worry about it as beyond what happened in the Supreme Court dismissing it. I worry about it as, like, a statement that a whole group of the American population is willing to invalidate the votes of other Americans.
Look, even if you're not a lawyer, if you're a layperson, just imagine what this would mean if it was a viable lawsuit. That at any time, when it doesn't involve something as tangible as water rights or border disputes or something like that, where the people of your state are actually directly affected, which is what you need in order to bring a suit, right? That's what the standing doctrine is all about. New York can start suing Missouri or Nevada or Arkansas for all manner of, you know, indirect and diluted harm just because they want to. I mean, it's a path to ruin, and it's a path that is completely at odds with our system of federalism, which, once again, I'm going to keep repeating this, used to be a thing that conservatives were in favor of. And what you see, you know, sometimes we talk about particular things that Donald Trump does or stands for, but I think it's useful to talk about what it means in the sweep of history. That, you know, Donald Trump is not a conservative, and you find a lot of quote-unquote Republicans, like those 126 members of the House, they're about outcome, not about principle, and they're about Trump. Rather, there are conservative Republican principles and standards, at least as historically understood. And so essentially, this is another thing that's important. When the Supreme Court basically summarily denied any relief in the case, not even allowing the case to be filed, they said it's because Texas hasn't shown standing. Let me read the statement of the court. Quote, the state of Texas's motion for leave to file a bill of complaint is denied for lack of standing under Article 3 of the Constitution. Texas has not demonstrated a judicially cognizable interest in the manner in which another state conducts its elections. All other pending motions are dismissed as moot, end quote. And the president comes out and says in his buffoonish way, well, it's a technicality, it's a technicality. You know, standing is set forth in the Constitution itself. What is also set forth in the Constitution, specifically, is that states under our federal system decide for themselves the time, place, and manner of how they conduct their elections. And so it's something that is inherent to the power and authority. Now, you can disagree with that, and you can decide, well, it would be nice if we had uniform standards in the country. And that's why you have polls closing at different times in different places and different methods of voting in different places. And Oregon is all mail, and some places don't have a lot of mail. But that's in the Constitution. And so you can't undo that and claim that you were harmed in some way in a distant state because some other state, even though it's provided for in the Constitution, chose for itself how to conduct its own elections, right? It's pretty simple.
Yeah, it's very simple. And what Texas was essentially saying is that those four states had made changes to their voting laws, whether it was to allow early voting or to allow mail-in votes, and that not all those changes went through the state legislatures, that instead, and this is very common, that state laws basically give the Division of Elections and the state itself the ability to decide, like, the election day is actually held on one day, but the manner in which people can vote, whether it's mail-in or in-person, whether there's an allowance for early voting, that the Division of Elections and the states get to decide that without going back through the state legislature. And so that's really the crux of their argument, is that no, you know, this had to be legislatively done. But that's actually not the way government works. Legislatures give grants of authority to executive branch agencies in states, and then those agencies make decisions about how they implement the rules that are the sort of broader things that are given by the legislature. And so it really is like, it really is an untenable view of the world for the state of Texas to say to the state of Pennsylvania, we don't like how you did your elections. We get to decide how you do your elections. And we're arguing that you're not in compliance with the
with your own rules,
legislative
right?
intent. I mean, with your own rules, basically. I wanted to read one thing from Texas, the lawsuit brought by Texas, or sort of just talk about it for a second. Because in addition to the fact that Texas had no standing, they also were basically just repeating the same allegations, the unsupported factual allegations. Like, there were no facts that would support any election fraud that they were arguing.
I mean, there was no evidence,
and they didn't bring no evidence. And they actually said that the probability of Vice President Biden winning was one in a quadrillion because President Trump was ahead in the early voting. And I just want to note, like, the first rule of lawyering, and you probably remember this from when you were being trained as a junior lawyer, but like, I can remember standing up in court in the DA's office and like someone handing you a file that you had to argue literally 10 seconds later. And like, the only instruction that was given to me was like, make sure you're honest about the facts and that you make reasonable arguments based on those facts, right? Like, as straight as you possibly can be. You only have 10 seconds. Like, make sure you like stay accurate. And then you read this and it's like,
it's so stupid. As some, you know, cranky people who I love were pointing out on Twitter yesterday, during the Electoral College vote, there were moments when Trump was ahead in the Electoral College vote because of the order in which state electors,
the votes came in,
were voting. Yeah. And like, what's up with this dump coming from this other state later in the day? But the other thing I want to point out for people to understand, you know, why Texas lost its suit, and you're kind of alluding to it a little bit, is that the Supreme Court, as we've already discussed, will very, very rarely take up a case of original jurisdiction. And one of the bases on which they will do it is if the issues that are presented are in no way able to be resolved or decided in some other court. In other words, the only place you can discuss it or adjudicate it is in the Supreme Court. But as you point out, the very arguments that are being made by Texas in its lawsuit against Pennsylvania and these other states have been made by Trump and his allies in those states, in those local courts, in those federal courts in those states, and they all lost. So the idea that these alleged irregularities can only be addressed in the Supreme Court is also, as a matter of fact and law, false. They're actually being dealt with in these dozens and dozens of suits in these other states. So that's yet another reason why the Supreme Court rejected it. Now, for lawyers and non-lawyers alike, there's some confusion about whether or not this was a unanimous decision. There is a partial dissent, and I'll read it to you, and then we have a friend and celebrity question along these lines, and it's a good question. Statement of Justice Alito, with whom Justice Thomas joins, quote, "In my view, we do not have discretion to deny the filing of a bill of complaint in a case that falls within our original jurisdiction." It cites to a case, Arizona v. California. Alito goes on to say, "I would therefore grant the motion to file the bill of complaint, but would not grant other relief. And I express no view on any other issue," end quote. And so on the issue of whether or not the complaint could even be received by the Supreme Court, it's 7-2, right? And all three of Trump's justices that he appointed side against Texas, side against the interests of the president. So that's significant. And we'll talk about how we can, you know, possibly spin that later. But then the question that comes is, well, do Thomas and Alito think that the case has no merit, separate and apart from this technical question about whether or not they have discretion to deny the filing of the complaint? And I got an email over the weekend, and he said I could read the email on the show, from Paul Giamatti, who plays the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, Chuck Rhodes, on the popular Showtime series Billions. And so from time to time, Paul will email me when he has a question, and I will answer. But I told him I would answer this question with you on the show. So here's the question. Paul asks, "If you had a moment to explain something, I'd appreciate it. The fine point of what Alito and Thomas said, I see many different takes on it. They recognize Texas's right to bring the case, to argue it. They'd have heard it. They also signaled they'd have found no merit in it. So his question goes to this point that I'm raising. What is it that we believe Alito and Thomas are saying about the merits of the case?
Yeah, and I feel that they added unnecessary confusion to this because they didn't register it as a formal dissent. And so that's why I think there's a debate about, is it a dissent, is it not a dissent, and is it a unanimous opinion? And they didn't technically register it as a dissent. There are a couple points to be made, I think. The first is that this isn't the first time that Scalia and Alito have argued this, that all matters, that the Supreme Court is compelled to take any complaint under its original jurisdiction capacity. That is not the law. It has not been the established law, but they have pushed for that before. And so I think it's worth saying that, like, this is a bee in their bonnet, that they think the Supreme Court has to accept that the Supreme Court shouldn't be just dismissing it and saying, you have no standing, you don't get to come in. They think they should have accepted it and then dealt with sort of the further questions. But I do read it to say that they would not have granted the relief. And again, I sort of personally think sometimes, like, you know, the thing that your grandparents always used to say, like, discretion is the better part of valor. Like, you know, they have this longstanding objection, but they didn't need to state it here. And if they really wanted to state it here, they probably should have written more than essentially two sentences, because they sort of raised these questions.
But you make the point very well. Like, I'm looking back and reading it, and I think I should amend what I said, because I referred to it as a dissent. I use that word. But the language is statement of Justice Alito, with whom Justice Thomas joins. They don't use the word dissent. And it's also the case, by the way, in Supreme Court practice on things like this. Like, we don't actually know what the internal vote was. What we do know is there were no recorded public dissents, and nobody decided to do that. So I think you can reasonably surmise that there were no dissents, but we can't know that for certain.
Do you want to hear something interesting?
Yeah, always.
In the case of New Jersey versus Delaware, Justice Breyer recused, so there were eight justices who heard the case.
Did he have an interest in the river or something?
He had some investments in BP.
Oh.
He had some investments in BP, I believe. So he recused, and then there were eight justices. It was 6-2 in favor of Delaware. You know who the two dissenting judges were on my side? Well, not on my side, on the side of the state of New Jersey.
Alito and Thomas?
I think it was Scalia and Alito.
And how'd that make you feel?
I just noticed it last night. I think that's right. I just noticed it last night. I was like, interesting.
So I agree with you. And I think most smart people that I've either talked to or seen write about this take the language at face value, which is they don't think there's discretion in denying the filing of the bill of complaint. But when you say, but would not grant other relief, the relief that's sought is the relief that's sought. And if they're saying they wouldn't grant other relief, that means what it says. But
yeah,
it's odd.
So
but I will say
it's odd.
It's not 100% in my mind. Because
yeah.
Why say that? You know, why say that you're prejudging the merits of the case? What's the point of allowing something to be filed if you were summarily saying in advance of any hearing that you would not grant other relief? And the other confusing part is the third part, which is to say, I mean, it seems to me that that's the sum total of issue. The granting of the motion to file the bill of complaint is one thing, and then not granting other relief is everything else. But then Alito also writes, and I express no view on any other issue. Well, what other issue are you talking about? Is that a reference to the merits? I don't know. So in answer to Paul Giamatti, I agree with you, Anne, and the others who say, it looks like really it's a 9-0 probably against any relief here, and that they don't think highly of the merits of the claims that Texas is making, but it's a little confusing. And I can see why people don't necessarily understand what Alito and Thomas were saying. But the bottom line is, you know, putting aside that little philosophical discussion for insiders here, the President of the United States has complained about Obama judges ruling against him, has complained about Democratic governors and secretaries of state stymieing him. What I don't understand is why people thought this was going to be a good idea given the uphill battle, and how on earth Trump and his allies can argue that somehow they're being held back and they're being hurt when it's basically a conservative Supreme Court that immediately and summarily denied this gambit by Texas. I mean, I guess they'll find a way, right? But it seems to me at the end of the day, they have hurt themselves by bringing all these cases and made a better case for the idea that they lost fair and square.
Yes, I agree with that, particularly with the Supreme Court. And I think, look, the president has been really outspoken in basically saying we need to get to the Supreme Court. And I think saying in a pretty clear and direct way that he expected the Supreme Court, particularly the justices that he had put on, to be amenable to his arguments, right? I mean, I think he sort of, you know, he talked a lot about getting to the Supreme Court. And I think there's a few points that are worth making. I mean, one is, you know, Biden won by a lot, right? I mean, this is Biden's victory is decisive. He won by more than 7 million votes. He's got the most votes of any president, 81 million votes in American history in the Electoral College. It's 306 to 232. That's a significant victory. And this was a terrible lawsuit. I mean, I think, you know, I'm mocking the one in a quadrillion, but it really is a lawsuit without any evidence or legal theories or standing.
That's how Trump and his folks are trying to explain it away. They're saying basically the court was chicken and they didn't get to the merits. So they can still say, well, we may have won, but they chickened out and they want, you know, us to fight it in some other way. But you know, that's not an accurate description of how it unfolded.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, I guess my caution is for future elections and for, you know, the Supreme Court absolutely did the right thing here. And there's no question in my mind they made the right decision. So, Preet, just a couple other quick points. I mean, first of all, I just want to point out that my favorite litigants to join this lawsuit, and again, yeah, there were 17
I know
states
what you're
that joined,
say.
126 Republican Congress people, the President of the United States, but my favorites were the, I don't know, unrecognized territories of New California and New Nevada.
Yeah. Haven't been to New Nevada. I think I was in New California once.
So these are people from areas of those states that, yes, exactly, that decided they wanted their voices heard, so they made up their own states, which is interesting. And just the last point, which I think we just have to raise, is that the Texas AG, Paxton, is under state indictment. He's been charged with state crimes for fraud, and he's under federal investigation. And I've followed this closely. I mean, a number of his top lieutenants in the state of Texas filed a whistleblower lawsuit against him.
His own people, his own staff.
His own people. But his senior people, like his right-hand first assistant.
I want to dive into your experience once again, beyond just riparian rights, Anne. How many times, give me a ballpark figure, how many times did your top staff in the New Jersey Attorney General's office report you to the FBI?
Never. Not that I know.
Not even one time?
Not even one time.
You must have a lot of integrity.
It's a pretty extraordinary story about this guy. And so, I mean, a number of commentators have suggested that he filed the lawsuit looking for a pardon from the president. It's not clear to me that that's the case, but I think we need to see the... It's just worth noting that this is an individual who is been charged in the state with fraud, that he's alleged to have done political favors for an ally and to sort of have used his power in office as the Texas AG. The whole thing is just, it's sort of a fascinating tale.
You know, whether or not you think that's a legitimate reason, you know, it's one thing to say, well, you have this, you know, arguably corrupt attorney general in Texas who's trying to get on the right side of the president and get a favor of a pardon or whatever, you know, elaborate theory you can concoct. That's one thing. And you can say, well, he did that, et cetera. But it's not a one-off because as we keep pointing out, you know, 17 or 18 other attorneys general who were not in his position joined the suit and 126 members of Congress. What's their excuse? I can't state enough how angry people should be at the legitimizing effect of 120, the majority of the Republican caucus, including the leader, Kevin McCarthy, signed on to this ridiculous, asinine BS complaint that even an overwhelmingly conservative Supreme Court said, essentially, this is nonsense. So, you know, it's kind of dispiriting.
Yeah, it's very dispiriting because it's more than just signing on to a bad legal theory. It's signing on to the view that basically, if you don't like the way the election turns out, you can challenge the way that people in a state that voted for somebody else, the way that they vote. I mean, it's the whole idea that only the votes of your political party should count. I mean, it is an extreme view of the law and of the United States and of politics.
It's un-American, undemocratic, unpatriotic. It's un-a lot of things.
it's also a sign to me of just how extreme, like how the Republican Party has been in many ways. I never thought I would say this, but I did not believe that we would get to a point in time where the Republican Party would do something that is anti-democratic, in my view, in this way. And so I'm still deeply disturbed by the number of states and congresspeople who signed on to this, what is a completely frivolous lawsuit that lacked any merit, but also was in principle, on principle, they were basically, one state is trying to tell another state whether or not their vote is allowed to be counted. That can't possibly be right. And so, you know, I agree with you, Preet. It's really troubling.
So we've gone a little bit long, and you know, we didn't expect Bill Barr to be resigning yesterday, so that took up some
time. And you
time.
Didn't expect the riparian rights story.
Well, I love the riparian rights story. I think that's my favorite story of the hour. But something that we'll talk about, I think, a little bit more in the future, but we should mention so people don't think we're just blowing it off. And I wrote about it at some length in my note to Cafe Insiders last week, so obviously we're aware of it, is this admission by Hunter Biden, President-elect's son, that the Delaware U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI and the IRS, and we referenced this before with respect to Bill Barr, but that they are investigating his tax affairs.
Hunter Biden's tax affairs.
Hunter Biden's right. tax affairs. And as I wrote in my note, we're at a point now because of the president's statements, his track record, the way he tries to weaponize the Justice Department, where it is a legitimate question to ask, is something like this political payback, retribution, retaliation, given how the president conducted himself and people around him conducted themselves with respect to specifically Hunter Biden in the Ukraine affair. So I think there's reason to question all of this, but there's also, as I pointed out in my note last week, you know, some reasons to believe that it's legitimate and there's regularity here because of the reputation of the U.S. attorney in Delaware, because of the fact that it was kept quiet and wasn't utilized politically for, you know, last minute October surprise timing in connection with the election. And just because there's an investigation doesn't mean anything is going to happen. And maybe no wrongdoing was committed and no charge will be brought. But on the question of whether or not this is a bona fide, legitimate investigation, I think the jury is out because of what's been going on. But I, you know, I will say there's a lot of reason to believe that it is legitimate.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, we should follow this and we should talk more about it. I think what I liked about your note is that you rightly said exactly what you just said here, which is there are indicia that it's a real investigation and that it's been going on quietly for some time, and that there are questions about, you know, Hunter Biden's business activities and his taxes and potential acceptance of gifts. And so I think it's important that if it is a real investigation, that it be allowed to play out, right? And I agree with you about the reputation of the U.S. attorney, Weiss, David Weiss, who has a very good reputation, has served presidents of both political parties. I also, you know, I share your sentiment that, you know, it's not surprising that there's a little bit of questioning of, you know, is this legitimate? And part of that also just comes from the fact that the president of the United States spent, you know, a good chunk of time and sent Rudy Giuliani to Ukraine to try to get dirt on Hunter Biden because of Hunter Biden's role on the board of a company named Burisma. And so I think it's fair to sort of raise this question of, you know, it was the president's, you know, political goal for a long time was to discredit Joe Biden by attacking his son, Hunter Biden. And so now we have this investigation of Hunter Biden that looks like it may have started in 2018. And again, may be completely legitimate, but it's hard for it not to be colored, at least in some way, by that. And so what that would mean to me if I were sitting in the U.S. attorney's seat is that, and I'm obviously not, but is that they really have to follow the law and the facts rigorously. And they have to understand that, you know, these are very difficult situations. A lot of Americans will see this through a political lens, that, you know, President Trump was really very outspoken in his condemnation of Hunter Biden. And so, you know, it does look like there could be a political aspect to it. And so, again, I mean, you and I are, you know, career prosecutors, and obviously I want the facts and the law to dictate what happens. But I think that there's a lot that we're going to have to watch and pay attention to on this case, and that it deserves a higher level of scrutiny because of all the stuff that surrounds it. And it just is what it is.
All right. So that's all we have time for this week. I hope we're going to get a favorable report of the shearing of your husband's hair next weekend.
Oh, yes. I was, when you said shearing, I was like, sheep? I will keep you posted.
All right.
Yeah.
So, folks, whether you're an A-list Oscar-nominated actor like Paul Giamatti or not, we want to hear your questions. So send them to us at letters@cafe.com.
And we'll do our best to answer them. Take care.
Take care, Anne.
Bye.
That's it for this week's Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Maley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.